provided boat service to the islands, called the authorities' chairman, Jimmy Smith, in Falmouth on Cape Cod. "There's been an accident," he said. "It's Ted Kennedy's car and somebody's dead. We don't know who it is yet. I thought you'd like to know." Ferry promised to call back when he had more information. Starkey, somewhat brash and outspoken, but a well-liked lawyer, Smith had used his influence to secure hard-to-get reservations for Ted Kennedy's Oldsmobile to be transported to Martha's Vineyard on Wednesday. Return passage was booked for Sunday morning at 9:50 a.m. out of Oak Bluffs. An assistant district attorney within whose jurisdiction the accident had occurred, Smith had taken Ferry's call in a library, furnished with the photographic memorabilia of his work as advance man and coordinator for various Kennedy campaigns. Captivated by John F. Kennedy, as the one politician in Massachusetts who didn't have his hand out, Smith had enlisted early as one of an army of young idealistic lawyers who were to become the foot soldiers in a Kennedy march to the White House. In 1960, Smith advanced campaign appearances in North Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, states in the Northern Plains under the charge of Ted Kennedy. When Ted himself became a candidate for the U.S. Senate in 1962, Smith was floor monitor at the Democratic State Convention that gave the first-time office seeker the party's endorsement. After that election, Ted Kennedy inscribed a Philippe Halsman portrait of himself to James Smith, who helped us fight the good fight. Smith had gone on to work Kennedy campaigns in 1964 and 1968. Cape Codders have wondered for some time if one of their number actually might be close to the Kennedy apparatus, the weekly Cape Cod News reported. Jimmy Smith appears to me mighty close. Smith called Kenneth O'Donnell. The former White House appointments secretary and political strategist lived in Jamaica Plain, a suburb of Boston. O'Donnell had little reaction to the news of the accident. He asked Smith to keep him informed. Smith called O'Donnell's brother Warren in Worcester. An advance man for both Kennedy and Johnson presidential campaigns, he had played football at Harvard with Ted Kennedy. More volatile than his brother, Warren wanted to do something, he said. How can we find out what's happening? Smith knew Chief Arena as a very friendly, congenial guy with a lot of sophistication, and had rejoiced when he'd been chosen Edgartown Chief of Police. I thought he would be good for Edgartown because they're so provincial over there. Smith wasn't concerned about Arena calling a shot, whatever the case turned out to be. But he wasn't going to use his position in the district attorney's office to find out what was going on in Edgartown. Chapter 3. Arena strode into town hall at 10 o'clock with no inkling of what was ahead of him. He wasn't surprised to find Harvey Ewing and Culber Smith waiting to see him, given the lightning speed with which Edgartown's gossip network had broadcast the news that Senator Kennedy was at the police station. Arena asked the two local reporters to wait outside. Ewing raised an eyebrow. Arena had never denied him access to the police station before. Arena greeted Carmen Salvador at the station's front desk. A sweet-faced woman of an unexcitable temperament, she had been relaying messages to and from the communications center about the accident at Chappaquiddick when Kennedy appeared at her desk. "How are you?" Kennedy said. "Can I use your phone?" "You can use the chief's," Salvador said. She led Kennedy into an adjoining office. "Kennedy looked really nervous," Salvador reported. "He seemed to think I knew all about what had happened, but I didn't. I thought someone had taken his car for a joyride." A tall man had followed Kennedy into the station. He too had asked to use the telephone. Salvador watched him misdial the phone on her desk, make two calls that made no sense to her, then joined Ted Kennedy in Arena's office and closed the door. Kennedy was using the phone when Arena entered his office and said, "Hello, Senator. I'm Jim Arena." Kennedy hung up, came around the desk to shake Arena's outstretched hand and said, "Hello, Jim." From his state trooper days at Suffolk County Courthouse in Boston, Arena recognized the other man in the office as former U.S. Attorney Paul Markham. He said, "I'm sorry about the accident." "Yes, I know," Kennedy said. "I was the driver." nothing in my prior career as a police officer, Arena recalled later, had prepared me for standing in a wet bathing suit and shaking hands with a United States senator and a Kennedy, who tells me he is the driver of a car from which I have just removed the body of a beautiful young girl. I was stunned. Arena was struck by the incongruity of the situation. Our roles could have been reversed. The senator was in clean, dry clothes, poised, confident, and in control, using my office and telephone. I'm standing in a puddle of water in a state of confusion, thinking, I had only minutes before broken the news of a personal tragedy. He's now telling me quite calmly he knows all about. Arena had assumed the accident victim had driven the car off Dyke Bridge herself. He said, Do you happen to know where Rosemary Keough is from, so we can notify her next of kin? It isn't Cricket Keough. It's Mary Jo Kopechne, Kennedy said. I've already notified her parents. Arena asked how to spell the last name. Kennedy only knew how to pronounce it. We can find out how to spell it later, Markham suggested. What would you like for me to do? Kennedy said. We must do what is right, or we'll both be criticized for it. The senator's demeanor certainly worked a calming effect on me, Arena said later. I automatically fell back on years of police training and began to process the matter as though it was a routine traffic case. As far as Arena could see, it was a motor vehicle accident, he said. The first thing we have to do is to have a statement from you about what happened. Would it be all right if I wrote it out? Kennedy said, requesting time undisturbed to prepare the statement. Arena led the way to an unoccupied town office down the corridor from the police station, so the senator could have some privacy. Kennedy asked Arena to return to Chappaquiddick to see that his car got out and cleared okay. Arena was glad for the reprieve. The admission that Senator Kennedy had been the driver of the fatal accident car thoroughly rattled him. On the way to the ferry, Arena collected his thoughts around self-reminders of the proper police procedures to follow. When he returned to the station to receive Kennedy's statement in this suddenly extraordinary automobile accident. Dr. Mills was also taking pains in dealing with a case in which so famous a name was rumored to be involved. As medical examiner, Mills could call for an autopsy to be made on the accident victim, or one could be ordered by the district attorney. A modest man of cautious disposition, Mills hesitated to exercise his own authority. Instead, he called the state police barracks at Oak Bluffs, following a directive that all communications with the district attorney's office be routed through the state police. Mills told Officer Richard DeRoche to contact the district attorney's office in New Bedford. Tell them I have the case of a girl who was trapped in a submerged vehicle for a matter of hours and has obviously drowned. That I am fully satisfied with my diagnosis of drowning by immersion. That I don't know who she is, but she is reputed to be an employee of the Kennedy family. And if it is the judgment of the district attorney or his assistant that an autopsy is indicated, then I am asking for one. Mills wasn't making the request for medical reasons. We almost never do autopsies in drowning cases on the island. I was requesting the consideration of an autopsy because of the connection with a prominent person. That was particularly important in my mind. I felt it was too big an issue for me to handle single-handedly. I felt the evidence of drowning was conclusive, but I'm no detective. Chapter 4 Registry of Motor Vehicles Inspector George Red Kennedy and his assistant Robert Mola were waiting for Arena at the ferry landing. Kennedy was fishing when he received a radio call that Edgartown police were looking for him. A 14-year veteran of the registry, Kennedy was reputed to be a good investigator by his colleagues. Arena thought he was a nice guy, but not too bright. The automobile had been righted in Poca Pond when Arena returned to Dyke Bridge, but the current was still too swift for the car to be pulled from the water. John Farrar had observed large air bubbles rise to the surface when the automobile turned over. He was continuing to dive, looking for more bodies. Arena told him, You can call off your search. I have the driver. We know who the girl is. There was nobody else in the car. Arena joined registry inspectors taking measurements of the accident scene. Dyke Road was 15 feet wide at the bridge, and the bridge was built at a 27-degree angle to the road. The car had landed 51 feet from the start of the bridge and catapulted 23 feet 7 inches forward, and 5 feet outward from the exit gouges on the rub rail. Inspector Kennedy noted, according to the skid marks, the wheel of the right side of the car skidded some 18 feet before it went over the rub rail. The wheel on the left side showed skid marks of 33 feet 2 inches, to the point where the car left the bridge and flipped into the water. Arena's inspection revealed, no skid marks on the bridge or dirt road prior to reaching the bridge that I could see. When tide approached dead low, the car was dragged from the pond. As the rear-end license plate emerged, Huck Look, watching the salvage operation from the bridge, walked over to Officer Brugure to say, that is the same car I saw last night. Brugure reported what Look told him to Arena. Do you know who was driving that car last night? Arena said. Look hadn't the slightest idea. Only what I told Bob. It appeared to be a man and a woman, and maybe somebody else in the back seat. Well, it was Senator Ted Kennedy, Arena said. One of the few registered Democrats in Edgartown, Look was horrified. Holy Jesus, he said. Then, in mock recantation, I didn't see a thing. To Registry Inspector Kennedy, Look confirmed having seen a vehicle with similar description to vehicle in the accident, whose occupants looked like two persons, one male and one female, with male operating vehicle. Farrar waded to the car, rear wheels resting upon the banking, front end partially submerged. The windshield, though shattered, was still held intact by safety film. Extensive damage had been done to the passenger side doors and the car's top. The upper right edge of the roof had broken the impact of meeting the water. Momentum had carried the car over onto its roof, Farrar said. For that reason, I believe initially a large amount of air was trapped inside. That one window was open and two others broken would not prevent an air bubble from forming. Farrar opened the driver's side door and checked the dashboard. The key was in the ignition. The light switch was in the on position. The gear wand was in drive. The car was full of broken glass. A hairbrush and a sodden Boston Globe for Friday, July 18th, were on the floor of the back seat. When the trunk was opened, Farrar observed it to be remarkably dry. Arena's inspection of the car only added to his growing puzzlement about the accident. I was far from being an expert, but I did have certain training beyond that of the average layperson in the matter of accidents. The driver of the car would have had to have taken a really hard blow to the head. The windshield on the driver's side was badly smashed in. Arena found it difficult to reconcile Ted Kennedy's appearance at the police station with that of the driver of a car in such an accident. Before the car was hitched to John Album's wrecker, Arena took from the glove compartment a leatherette folder containing the automobile's registration, several maps, and personal effects, and a lease for the rental of a cottage on Chappaquiddick to Joseph Gargan for 10 days beginning July 10th. A New Hampshire news photographer and sometime Newsweek correspondent vacationing on Chappaquiddick, Jack Hubbard, had been alerted to the accident at Dyke Bridge in time to shoot on-the-scene photographs of the car being dragged from Poca Pond. Believing then it was strictly a local matter of no particular significance, Hubbard offered his roll of exposed film to Bob Hyde of the Standard Times. An English teacher at Martha's Vineyard Regional High School, Hyde had ridden a bicycle to Dyke Bridge to cover the story. Hubbard wasn't the only reporter on holiday in Edgartown. The crowd in front of Town Hall had grown considerably in the hour Arena was gone, and there were a number of journalists, indistinguishable from tourists and townspeople, who had stopped to find out what was going on. Arena was dismayed to find James Reston, political columnist and executive editor of the New York Times, waiting to see him in the corridor. I'd only just found out about the accident, Arena said later. And right off the bat, I've got one of the most powerful newspapers in the country camped on my doorstep. Arena asked Reston to wait outside with other reporters. A longtime summer resident of Edgartown, Reston had purchased the Vineyard Gazette in 1967. To Harvey Ewing, Reston appeared to be enjoying the role of police beat reporter sniffing out a breaking story. Reston was reverting to the style of an aggressive news hawk. He was a lot more excited than I thought he should be about the accident. But he was obviously putting things together faster than the rest of us were at this point. Reston had slipped a note through Carmen Salvador, asking Ted Kennedy to see him, and stationed a reporter at the back door of the town hall to prevent the senator from eluding the press. To Ewing, he said, "We want to see if we can catch him before he gets away." Arena recognized Jack Crimmins standing in the corridor. Crimmins had chauffeured Ted Kennedy when Arena was assigned to Logan Airport in Boston as a state trooper. When Arena walked into the town accountant's office, Paul Markham was seated at a desk, and Ted Kennedy was pacing. "The statement was nearly finished," Markham said. Arena took the opportunity to take a real close look at Ted Kennedy. I found it hard to believe the senator had been in a major automobile accident. His face bore no traces of any marks. He never sat down or appeared in any kind of physical discomfort. If he had been injured, in shock, or confused, nothing of it lingered in our meeting, to my observation. But the senator made it a point to tell me 3 times, without my asking, that he was the driver of the accident car. It was as though he wanted to make sure I got it right. Arena could think of no reason why Ted Kennedy would admit to that if it were not true. Arena was summoned to the police station to take a call from Robert Carroll, chairman of Edgartown's Board of Selectmen, a real estate developer and entrepreneur chronically embroiled in controversies with local planning boards. Carroll was a fervent Kennedy supporter. He said,
"I understand somebody went off a bridge in Teddy Kennedy's car."
"Yeah," Arena said. "And the worst of it is, Ted was driving." "Oh, Jesus," Carroll said. "If there's anything I can do to help, let me know." Markham came into Arena's office with the accident report. Since Arena wasn't sure he could read Markham's writing, he said, "Do you mind if I have this typed?" Markham thought that was a good idea. Arena intended to have Carmen Salvador transcribe the 2 pages, but she was busy answering the station's 2 telephones. Arena sat at his desk to type the statement himself. He had no difficulty deciphering the spiky scrawl, complete with cross-outs and write-overs, with which Markham had transcribed the senator's dictation. But what Arena read astounded him. No wonder Ted Kennedy was showing no ill effects from the accident. According to his verbatim report, the accident had occurred more than 10 hours ago. On July 18, 1969, at approximately 11:15 p.m. in Chappaquiddick, Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, I was driving my car on Main Street on my way to get the ferry back to Edgartown. I was unfamiliar with the road and turned right onto Dyke Road, instead of bearing hard left on Main Street. After proceeding for approximately 1/2 mile on Dyke Road, I descended a hill and came upon a narrow bridge. The car went off the side of the bridge. There was 1 passenger with me, one Miss Mary, a former secretary of my brother, Senator Robert Kennedy. The car turned over and sank into the water and landed with the roof resting on the bottom. I attempted to open the door and the window of the car, but have no recollection of how I got out of the car. I came to the surface, and then repeatedly dove down to the car, in an attempt to see if the passenger was still in the car. I was unsuccessful in the attempt. I was exhausted and in a state of shock. I recall walking back to where my friends were eating. There was a car parked in front of the cottage, and I climbed into the back seat. I then asked for someone to bring me back to Edgartown. I remember walking around for a period and then going back to my hotel room. When I fully realized what had happened this morning, I immediately contacted the police. Arena left his office with the typed statement. Walter Steele was standing in the corridor. skinny, balding, owlish in appearance behind thick glasses. Steele had not yet logged 2 months as a special prosecutor. Steele's curiosity had been aroused by the crowd gathered outside town hall. Amazed to see the usually impeccable police chief, barefoot, wearing a damp t-shirt and swim trunks, Steele wanted to know, what the hell is going on?
Arena nodded toward the door of the town accountant's office.
Ted Kennedy's in there, he said, suggesting Steele stick around. I might need you later.
Arena gave Ted Kennedy a copy of the statement. He retained a carbon to check over for typing mistakes. Kennedy read the statement in silence.
Okay, he said. Then, we are trying to get a hold of Burke Marshall.
Markham described Marshall as a Kennedy family lawyer.
The senator wanted the statement looked over by his attorney before it became part of the record, he said. Could you please hold it until I talk to Burke Marshall?
Arena had some questions he wanted to ask, principally about the long delay in reporting the accident.
Markham assured him, the senator will answer questions after he has consulted his attorney.
The Kennedy asked to talk to a lawyer seemed a reasonable request to Arena.
I figured Kennedy would be eager to clear the matter up.
Arena agreed to hold the statement and forego further questions, a decision he would come to regret as something of a low point in my particular case.
Arena asked to see Ted Kennedy's driver's license. The senator didn't have it with him. He said, I can't find my wallet.
Arena wanted to know if the license had been properly renewed. Kennedy was sure it had been. Massachusetts law required every driver to have a license upon his person, or in some easily accessible place for presentation after an accident. Police could arrest without warrant and keep in custody for 24 hours any person operating a motor vehicle who did not have a license in his possession. The senator's inability to produce a license was in clear violation of the law.
Arena gave no thought to pressing the charge. A lot of guys forget their license when they change pants, he said.
As a state trooper, Arena told drivers without licenses to report to the nearest police station. If they failed to show up or couldn't produce a valid license, he then issued a citation. In Kennedy's case, Arena was bending enforcement to a breaking point. Possession of a license was required only when actually engaged in operating a motor vehicle, Arena said. There's nothing in the law that requires a driver to have his license on him when he walks into a police station to report an accident. The lack of a license, combined with the delay in reporting the accident, unexplained by the statement it had taken Senator Kennedy more than an hour to compose, were unwished-for complications in an accident Arena had thought he could handle as a routine traffic case. He was anxious to discharge the statutory requirement to report the fatality to the district attorney's office. But Arena was reluctant to contact Edmund Denise in New Bedford. Instead, he called State Police Detective Lieutenant George Killen, chief investigator for the district attorney's office on Cape Cod. Killen didn't have much to say when Arena reported Senator Ted Kennedy had been the driver in a fatal automobile accident. He did offer the assistance of the district attorney's office if Arena wanted it. Arena didn't. The senator had given him a statement. Arena and a registry inspector were conducting an investigation. Steele caught a glimpse of Ted Kennedy when Arena left the town accountant's office. He was gratified the senator waved, apparently remembering their days together at the Suffolk County District Attorney's office. Fresh from law school, Kennedy had been paid $1 a year as an assistant district attorney. The caseload for assistants was backbreaking, but Kennedy had handled no more than a dozen prosecutions in his year of employment. He had argued one case in court. Kennedy spent most of his time giving speeches all over Massachusetts, preparing to run for office. After 14 years as an assistant district attorney, Steele resigned only 2 months before to devote himself to private practice and the newly created position of special prosecutor for Dukes County District Court. Steele spotted District Court Clerk Tommy Teller entering the town hall. Teller had learned about the accident from his brother-in-law, Huck Look, Teller said, "Jesus, Walter, Ted Kennedy's in big trouble. I heard he was driving a car that was in a bad accident."
Steele walked into the police station to have Arena corroborate Teller's story, and recognized Paul Markham seated on a bench across from Carmen Salvador's desk. Steele said to him, "How are you?" Clearly, Markham wasn't very well. Red-eyed, his face drawn with exhaustion, Markham looked like he'd had a rough night. He stood up and abruptly announced, "I'm going over to the Shire Town Inn." Steele volunteered to go with him. There was about Markham's craggy good looks an air of such anguish that Steele's curiosity about the accident was momentarily subdued. Highly regarded in Boston legal circles, Markham had resigned as U.S. attorney for Massachusetts in April and was rumored to be in line for a judgeship. Markham was silent the two blocks to the Shire Town Inn, a shabby, genteel establishment of two nondescript houses connected by a brick courtyard. An outside stairway led to a second-floor porch and a meager room with scant furnishings. Markham collected various articles to stuff into a canvas bag. By the time he had returned to Town Hall, Steele had pieced together from Markham's muttered half-sentence responses to his tentative questions an incredible story. Ted Kennedy had driven a car off Dyke Bridge. He had escaped the accident uninjured, but a young woman accompanying him had drowned. The accident had gone unreported for more than 9 hours. Steele was astonished. "Jesus Christ, Paul." "I know," Markham said. Steele suggested, "There might be a problem." Arena was a decent man, a fair-minded chief of police. But the district attorney with jurisdiction over the case was Edmund Denise, an ambitious politician with a demonstrated penchant for publicity, Steele said. "He can be a pretty intractable guy." Senator Kennedy was sequestered in Arena's office with registry inspectors George Kennedy and Robert Mola. After formally introducing himself, Inspector Kennedy read from a Miranda card of rights. "You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him represent you while you are being questioned. If you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed to represent you before any questioning, if you want one." The senator listened glumly to the recitation, usually given prior to an interrogation. He said he understood his rights. Inspector Kennedy asked for the senator's driver's license and registration. The senator thought the registration was in the accident car. He didn't have his license with him, he said. "Sometimes I leave it in my car in Washington, because I own two cars. I will place a call for you immediately and see if I didn't leave it there." Kennedy called his Senate office in Washington. He asked his administrative aide, David Burke, to see if the license had been left in the other car, and to provide the complete name, address, and date of birth for Mary Jo Kopechne, required for the registry's report of the accident. Inspector Kennedy read over the senator's statement. He said, "I would like to know about something." "I have nothing more to say," the senator said brusquely. "I have no comment." Markham assured Inspector Kennedy, "The senator will make a further statement after he has contacted his lawyer." Inspector Kennedy did not insist on asking questions about the accident in order to make a report. The senator had let him know in no uncertain terms he had no intention of saying more. The cool manner the senator had maintained throughout the 3 hours he had spent at the police station was beginning to unravel. The senator was anxious to leave the premises. Markham was calling Air Charter Services seeking to book a flight to Hyannis. Arena called Robert Carroll, a licensed pilot who owned a Piper Comanche. "Can you fly the senator to Hyannis?" Arena asked. "One of the motor vehicle guys is going to use his own car to drive him to the airport." Carroll agreed to leave his office at once. Senator Kennedy was fretful about reporters. Carmen Salvador told him were waiting outside the police station to see him. Arena was sympathetic to Kennedy's dilemma. He wasn't looking forward to meeting the press himself. But for the senator, Arena provided an escape route that would allow him to evade reporters. Clearing the corridor of unauthorized personnel, Arena led Kennedy and Markham to a utility room in the rear of the building. A door provided access to a parking lot. Bob Hyde of the Standard Times was standing vigil outside the door when Kennedy dashed for Registry Inspector Robert Mola's unmarked Plymouth. He tried to get a statement, but Kennedy wouldn't say anything. The senator appeared very shook, Hyde observed. He looked like the wrath of God. En route to the airport, Kennedy muttered, "Oh my God, what has happened? What has happened?" He repeated the phrase during an uneventful 10-minute flight to Hyannis Airport. Carol taxied the plane to a parking area without waiting for directives from line boy John Celentano. The passenger side door opened and Ted Kennedy climbed out, drenched in perspiration. Kennedy walked, then jogged to a car parked near the runway's tarmac. Celentano thought he looked in a semi-state of shock. Chapter 5 Arena told reporters allowed into the corridor he could not release a statement about the accident from Senator Kennedy until he received permission. Furious that police had collaborated with the senator to avoid confronting reporters, James Reston demanded the statement be released at once, with an accompanying story. Arena politely declined to do so. He was bothered the victim's last name had been left blank in the senator's report. The handbag he had brought back to the police station from the accident scene inspired the only investigative initiative Arena would find time to demonstrate in the escalating, pressurized atmosphere at Town Hall. It hadn't seemed out of line for the handbag to be found in the accident car, since Rosemary Keough was identified as a Senate employee. "That kind of lulled me into thinking she was just one of Kennedy's crew," Arena said. "That maybe here's a bunch of girls from Washington, and if Mary Jo is in the regatta group staying at the motel, then this other girl has got to know her." Arena called the Katama Shores motor inn and asked to speak to Rosemary Keough. "Basically, I wanted to find out how to spell Mary Jo's last name, not what the handbag was doing in the car." Keough sounded wary and suspicious after Arena identified himself as chief of police. He overheard a muffled consultation going on at the other end of the line, before Keough came back on to spell out Mary Jo Kopechne's name. "Keough was sending someone to the police station to pick up her handbag," she said. Arena turned it over to a man who looked reputable an hour later. He didn't question him. "Maybe I gave it away too easy, that I figured he knew what bag to ask for, and there was nothing compromising in it." It didn't occur to Arena until later that from the tremulous quaver in her voice, Rosemary Keough had known about the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. "She seemed very down in the dumps, like she knew what had happened. I'm thinking, she's way out at Katama, and I'm down here. How the hell does she know about the accident?" But it was too late for Keough to be questioned. When Arena called the motel again, she had checked out. Arena didn't get to question Jack Crimmins either. He wasn't sure what Ted Kennedy's driver was doing hanging around the police station after the senator left. "I thought maybe he's with Ted and just waited around to see me. That maybe he was there to put the arm on me, to say, 'Hey, go easy on the boss.' Or did he want to tell me something?" When Arena went out to the corridor looking for him, Crimmins was gone. Arena's only source of information about the accident was Senator Kennedy's report, and that statement didn't add up at all in Walter Steele's opinion. The wrong turn was particularly contradictory. Kennedy was familiar enough with the geography of Chappaquiddick to know to bear left instead of turning right on Dyke Road, properly identified in his report, if he were going to the ferry. Yet he'd made the turn anyway. The senator's approximation of the distance from the Main Street intersection to Dyke Bridge was right on the money. Questionable, too, was the shock and exhaustion Kennedy said he'd suffered after the accident. The senator had not sought medical attention after the accident, nor did he appear to be injured at the police station, factors which combined to suggest that the senator may have tried to avoid responsibility by delaying his report. As it was,
Kennedy hadn't done so until after the accident was discovered and a body been recovered from his car. Unless there were mitigating circumstances to account for the 10-hour delay, Arena had no choice but to seek a complaint against Ted Kennedy for leaving the scene of an accident, Steele said. That's all you can do. The statement is in clear violation of the statute. That Arena had been asked to hold the statement until it had been cleared by Burke Marshall, Steele thought, was utterly foolhardy. You can't release this to the press. It's a goddamn confession, for Christ's sake. Any lawyer advising Ted Kennedy was likely to be calling up any minute to say not to release anything. Steele said, they can't want this made public. Steele wanted to know if the district attorney's office had been notified about the fatal accident. Arena said he'd called George Killen. The statute says you have to notify the district attorney, Steele said. Let's not take any chances with that son of a bitch. Reluctantly, Arena called Edmund Denise in New Bedford. He recited only that portion of Kennedy's statement in which the senator had admitted to driving the car. Denise didn't take it very well. We're in this case right now, he shouted. He's all done. He's gone. Jesus, Arena said when Denise hung up. I don't know what's going on. It sounds to me like he's coming into the case. Denise had authority to take over any investigation within his district, merely by announcing his intention to do so. Before Arena could absorb the implications of the conversation with Denise, the telephone rang again. George Killen said, This is just a motor vehicles case. You must have had 100 of these damn things when you were with the state police. You don't need our help. Killen once again offered the assistance of the district attorney's office. But he made it clear, it's your case. What was even clearer was that Denise had talked to his chief investigator on Cape Cod, and Killen had cooled the district attorney's ardor about taking over. Arena said, Killen was right in some respects to think this was a state trooper kind of thing, knowing my experience as a highway cop. It wasn't the classic kind of case you called the district attorney's office about. My reaction was, with somebody like Ted Kennedy mixed up in it. If I didn't let Denise know about the accident, he'd go apeshit. In 1967, Denise had proclaimed, On Cape Cod, I depend heavily on Lieutenant George Killen. He is one of the most outstanding police officers in the country today. He speaks for me. I trust him with my life. As senior officer responsible for the investigation and prosecution of all criminal matters on Cape Cod and the islands of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, Killen had achieved near-legendary status. Tall, dapper, with great dignity of bearing, Killen's monumental reserve enhanced a strict adherence to the highest standards of rectitude in the investigation and preparation of cases for prosecution in Barnstable Superior Court. Killen deployed a small investigative staff with the skills of a field general. Lately, his office had been swamped with cases. It seemed every time the telephone rang, it was somebody else telling me, I got a body. Killen was winding down the investigation of the most sensational murder case in Cape Cod history. Under arrest for killing 4 young women, whose mutilated bodies were found buried in Truro Woods, was Anton Costa of Provincetown. Killen gave the major credit for breaking the complex case to Lieutenant Bernie Flynn, a veteran detective assigned to his office in 1967. A former New Bedford police officer who had placed first on the state police examination, Flynn was given the choice of assignment to the district attorney's office in New Bedford or Barnstable Courthouse. Flynn jumped at the chance to work on Cape Cod. Killen tracked Flynn to the Falmouth Country Club and had him paged off the greens. There's been an accident, Killen announced portentously. An accident, Flynn said. For Christ's sakes, we don't investigate accidents. We'll investigate this one, Killen said. It's Ted Kennedy. You better get over to Edgartown and see what the hell is going on. Killen also contacted the state police barracks in Oak Bluffs about an autopsy request made by Associate Medical Examiner Donald Mills. Mills was attending a patient when Officer Robert Lucas called with a message from Killen. If Mills was satisfied with his diagnosis,
and there was no evidence of foul play. No autopsy was necessary. Should Mills care to discuss the matter further, he could reach Killen at home. Mills was perfectly satisfied with Lieutenant Killen's decision, he said, when he instructed Eugene Fry to go ahead with embalming. Killen had suggested a blood specimen be taken for identification and analysis. Then Mills put the accident at Chappaquiddick out of his mind. I couldn't give it any more thought at the time, he said. Mills had a baby to deliver at Oak Bluffs Hospital. Fry was surprised no autopsy had been ordered in the case. I figured there should have been one for three reasons. The type of accident it was, the important people involved, and the fact that insurance companies would be hounding officials over double indemnity claims. Fry and his assistant undressed the body in a basement preparation room. A blood sample was drawn from the left armpit. As was customary in drowning cases, a body block was affixed under the diaphragm. From abdominal compression, Fry observed, a very slight bit of moisture and a slight bit of froth of a pinkish hue. He estimated it to be less than a teacup. I did raise an eyebrow in the sense that I was expecting much more moisture. Fry examined the scalp when he shampooed salt water and seaweed from the victim's hair. Because the car had gone over a bridge, Fry wondered if there might be some injury Dr. Mills had overlooked during his brief on-scene examination. Fry discovered no bruises or marks on the body, except for a slight abrasion on the left-hand knuckle. After washing the body with a solution of germicidal soap and spray-rinsing it, Fry cleaned all body orifices with an astringent. But he put off embalming, because he still expected Dr. Mills to change his mind about wanting an autopsy. Fry held everything in abeyance, awaiting identification of the body and specific instructions from the deceased's family, when he received a call from the Keelty Funeral Home of Plymouth, Pennsylvania. John Keelty had been authorized by Mrs. Joseph Kopechne to take charge of funeral arrangements. Fry was told to prepare the remains and forward the body to Pennsylvania as quickly as possible. Keelty provided the vital statistics Fry needed to make out a death certificate. The accident victim was Mary Jo Kopechne of 2921 Olive Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C. Born in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania on July 26, 1940. She was formerly employed as a secretary to the late Senator Robert Kennedy. The information had been supplied by the victim's mother. She described her daughter as 5'4", 110 pounds, Roman Catholic, and being maiden. Fry used a trocar, a large hollow needle attached to a vacuum motor, to penetrate the abdominal wall, pelvic area, and heart spaces, to remove excess body fluids that might be detrimental to good embalming. 16 ounces of formalin were inserted into the trunk, then an additional 16 ounces on aspiration. Fry's assistant did the embalming under his supervision. Fry carefully recorded all procedures, to keep ourselves refreshed in case we had to be questioned, he said later. We knew we had a hot cookie on our hands. Chapter 6 At 2:15 p.m., Arena logged another call from George Killen. Concerned about an autopsy request from Dr. Mills, Killen wanted Arena's opinion because he'd been at the accident scene when the body was recovered.
That's up to the medical examiner. It's not my say-so, Arena said.
He saw no reason to question the finding of death by drowning.
To the best of my observation, nothing else was wrong.
Killen was satisfied to leave the case in Arena's hands. He said,
You've got a tiger by the tail, Jim, but I'm sure you can handle it.
Arena was still waiting for permission to release Senator Kennedy's statement to an increasingly impatient corps of reporters standing outside the police station, when CBS News correspondent Ben Silver and a television crew invaded his office. An aggressive takeover reporter, Silver brushed aside Arena's protests in his determination to interview the police chief. Francis Broadhurst noticed more reporters were packing into the hot and airless corridor when he arrived at town hall. Cape Cod stringer for the Boston Herald Traveler, Broadhurst received word around 9 o'clock that one of Ted Kennedy's secretaries had been killed on Martha's Vineyard. He took the Island Queen out of Falmouth for Oak Bluffs and hailed taxi operator Christopher Look Sr. on the dock.
"You hear on the Kennedy thing?" Look said en route to Edgartown. Look suggested Broadhurst talk to his son. He knows a lot about it.
Look pulled up to a curb on Main Street when he spotted his son on the sidewalk. After introducing him to Broadhurst, he said, "Now tell him what you told me about the accident over at Chappie." Recognizing Broadhurst as a reporter, Huck Look backed away. He said, "I'm not saying a goddamn word."
Look joined a group of locals near the courthouse that included Edgartown attorney Dick McCarran. Look appeared so solemn during the discussion about an accident at Dyke Bridge, McCarran asked him, "What do you know about all this, Huck?"
"More than I want to know," Look said, but he wouldn't say anything else.
"You ought to go down and talk to young Farrar," Look Sr. suggested, when Broadhurst got out of his taxi. The first reporter to talk to the diver who had recovered the body from Poca Pond, Broadhurst was impressed by the good-looking muscular man, just returned to the turf and tackle from Chappaquiddick. Farrar had been diving since he was 15 and was a real enthusiast, technically knowledgeable and articulate to the point of compulsion about his specialty. Farrar was eager to discuss the recovery of the body he'd found in 8 feet of water in the back seat of Senator Kennedy's Oldsmobile.
"She was in what I call a very conscious position," Farrar said. "Her head was at the floorboards where the last bit of air would have been. It seems likely she was holding herself into a pocket of air to breathe." There had been no air in the car when Farrar reached the body. If an air bubble had been there earlier, her moving about would have dispersed it. But she could have been alive a good while after the car went off the bridge. How long, Farrar couldn't say. He'd read about persons trapped in submerged automobiles who had survived up to 5 hours by breathing a pocket of air. If he'd been called soon after the accident, Farrar thought, there was a good chance the girl could have been saved. At town hall, Broadhurst was told by Bob DiOrio, a Herald Traveler reporter flown from Boston with press photographer Jimmy O'Callaghan, a big story was about to come out of Arena's closed-door police station. Ted Kennedy was rumored to be the driver of a car in which a young secretary had been killed. A woman in the corridor Broadhurst didn't know said to him, "This won't see the light of day. This will all be covered up." But word of the accident was beginning to seep out. The Cape Cod Standard Times was delivering to subscribers a front-page bulletin supplied by its parent paper in New Bedford from a story Harvey Ewing had filed to beat a 1 o'clock deadline. Bulletin, Edgartown. The body of a young woman believed to be a secretary for Senator Edward M. Kennedy was recovered from the waters of Chappaquiddick Island following an auto accident. It was not immediately determined if the woman was alone in the car. Some members of the Kennedy family are on the island for the annual Edgartown Regatta. Another report of the accident was spreading the news farther away. At 2:45 p.m., an urgent message addressed to the director was put on the FBI teletype in Boston. "On this date, Dominic J. Arena, Chief of Police Edgartown, Martha's Vineyard, Mass., advised body of female found in overturned car in water. Tentatively identified as above was secretary to former Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Chief Arena confidentially states that driver of automobile was Senator Edward M. Kennedy, who was uninjured. Stated fact, Senator Kennedy was driver, is not being revealed to anyone." Chapter 7. Bernie Flynn was amazed at the scene of confusion at Edgartown Police Station when he greeted a harried Arena. Arena wasn't surprised to see a representative of the district attorney's office, inasmuch as he had talked to Killen. And, Bernie Flynn observed, he was probably relieved. Like, if anything too heavy comes up, the DA's office is there to take the weight off his shoulders. That's the usual reaction a local police chief has that's onto something big. He's thinking, this is where I can get off the hook. Until that happens, he's going to handle it. Flynn read over Ted Kennedy's report of the accident. "Personally, I thought it was bullshit," he said later. Flynn kept his disbelief to himself.
As far as I'm concerned, it's an automobile accident. I'm not involved.
I'm there so Denise can say, somebody from my office is on the case.
Only we aren't on the case. Nobody said, let's go and investigate this thing, why don't we take over?
So I'm standing in the background. I don't want to get in the way of Arena's game plan. I backed off and let him run it.
Flynn was careful to avoid displaying his presence too conspicuously to local reporters who might recognize him. He went to the small district attorney's office maintained at Edgartown's courthouse. Flynn had no emergency to report to Killen. In his judgment, the case wouldn't amount to anything. Flynn doubted Ted Kennedy would even be brought to court on a charge of leaving the scene, because he'd covered himself in the report saying he was exhausted and in a state of shock. The law was vague on how long you had to report an accident, and Kennedy did finally report the thing. In Flynn's opinion, Arena was in way over his head.
My impression was he wanted to help Ted Kennedy, but he didn't know how to go about it.
He didn't know what the hell to do with the case. He was trying to get out of doing anything.
George Killen wasn't anxious to do anything about the case either, or so it appeared when Walter Steele called him. Steele had reviewed the medical examiner's statutes, he said.
Maybe we should think about doing an autopsy. You know what they say, when in doubt, do an autopsy.
The diagnosis of drowning had been assumed because the body of Mary Jo Kopechne was found in a submerged automobile. That method of drowning was sensitive to misinterpretation. Killen wasn't enthusiastic about the idea. Dr. Mills was satisfied there was no evidence of foul play in the death. Steele abruptly ended the conversation, telling Arena, "Okay, we've covered all bases. The DA's been notified, an autopsy has been suggested. It's our case to do with what we think best." Steele was unhappy at the direction the case was taking. "Kennedy isn't being very nice to us, leaving a statement then taking off," he said. "It's a terrible position he's put us in. We've got a motor vehicle death here, and he's left us holding the bag. He's almost forcing us to charge him with leaving the scene." Arena was mystified why he had not yet received permission to release the statement. The press had grown clamorous in the corridor. Arena didn't blame them. The accident begged more answers than the senator's report supplied. Arena had a number of questions he wanted to ask Ted Kennedy himself, and regretted now he hadn't. "If everything had been clicking, I would have interrogated him much more thoroughly," Arena said later. "But unfortunately, at the time, there was so much confusion, and I was laboring under the idea that it wasn't going to end when he left the police station. I told myself, we'll be following up on this thing. Everything will ultimately come out. We'll clear everything up." When Arena went out to the corridor to soothe the impatience of reporters, James Reston was the most insistent that the Kennedy statement be released. The accident was a matter of public record to which the press was entitled to have information. Reston suggested Arena was being uncooperative. Arena went back to his office to consult Steele. "They want the statement," he said. "It's been more than 3 hours. Nobody's called me. I'm going to release it." Steele cautioned Arena to hold off. The statement contained an admission of guilt that could be prejudicial to Kennedy's case. If Arena released it, the senator would have a constitutional defense. "He can say he can't get a fair trial because of the publicity you created by giving his statement to the press." Arena thought it over. He didn't think an automobile accident was likely to have constitutional issues attached. The senator had known reporters were outside town hall waiting to talk to him when he sneaked out the back way. Kennedy expected the statement to be made public. Arena went into the corridor. He signaled for the attention of reporters. He said, "Senator Kennedy has given me the following statement." Arena was asked to read the statement a second time so reporters could take it all down. He was in the midst of a third recitation when he was called into the police station. Paul Markham was on the phone. Markham said, "Chief, we haven't been able to get a hold of Burke Marshall. Could I ask you to hold up the statement a little bit longer?" "I'm sorry," Arena said. "I've already released it."
"Oh, Jesus," Markham said. "Well, I had to. It's been too long a period of time. What did you expect me to do with people beating on my door?"
Arena held on to his equanimity.
The medical examiner had diagnosed death by accidental drowning, Arena said.
I'm treating it strictly as a motor vehicles investigation, that's all.
Markham hung up before Arena could ask when Senator Kennedy expected to get back to him to answer more questions, as he had promised to do. Arena had little beyond the statement to give reporters. The senator had been cooperative, considering the strain he was under, Arena said. He must have been in a state of shock after the accident.
Arena's own efforts to dive against the strong tidal current in Poca Pond had exhausted him, he said.
And I think I'm a pretty good swimmer.
Steele sidled up to the police chief.
Don't do any more talking, he said.
On his way home, where he maintained the Bureau's office, Harvey Ewing recollected his observations of Senator Kennedy at the Edgartown dock.
I'd watched him closely, and his movements were completely normal. My impression was he looked in good shape. At that point, I didn't know he had been the driver of the car or had done all the things he said he did in the statement. It was a complete mystery to me the more I thought about it. The biggest mystery was, what the hell had he been doing for 10 hours until he reported the accident?
To add to the puzzle, Ewing's son reported he'd taken Ted Kennedy over and back on the on time and asked him if he knew about the accident an hour before the senator reported it. Obviously, Ted Kennedy had not, as he had said, immediately contacted the police. Not that such incidents were unheard of during regatta weekends. A unique sailing event, the regatta was also something of a trial for Edgartowners. An invasion of sailors multiplied opportunities for the kind of high-spirited mischief that was as much a part of the event as the races themselves. Ewing knew from experience. You could count on at least a dozen people getting into trouble during most regatta weekends. Minor stuff, like drunk and disorderly, assaults, and sleeping on the beach. The accident at Chappaquiddick went beyond the standard rowdiness of race week, however. Ewing's paper was sending a reporter from New Bedford to work with him on a major story for Sunday's edition. Ewing set about gathering details on the accident. Basically, it was Ted Kennedy had driven a car off a bridge and some woman is dead. The larger implications of the accident hadn't registered yet. Ewing had no idea whether Kennedy could be cited for negligent operation or driving to endanger. That, he thought to himself, was left up in the air. Arena had said nothing about filing charges. Ewing was also serving a number of small radio stations as correspondent. They wanted anything I could give them, a voice on the scene. He used the same copy for an hour or so. Then, if I heard something new I thought was important, I'd add it and delete something else. Ewing was picking up tidbits from out-of-town reporters who had turned his dining room into an improvised press headquarters, sharing what little information there was about the story. One of the first to arrive at Ewing's house was Cornelius Hurley of the Boston Bureau of the Associated Press. Hurley had enjoyed privileged access to the Kennedys for years. He was able to reach a source at the compound in Hyannisport who asked not to be identified. Hurley was told Senator Kennedy was still in a state of shock and unable to hold a press conference to discuss the accident.
Chapter 8. In Falmouth, Jimmy Smith had waited anxiously for further reports from Dick Ferry about the accident at Chappaquiddick. A second call confirmed a fatality was involved, but the identities of neither the victim nor the driver of the car were known. Around 3 o'clock, Ferry called to say that Ted Kennedy had been identified as the driver of the accident car. Ferry didn't know what charges, if any, were to be lodged against the senator by Edgartown police. Smith was stunned. He had spent most of his boyhood in Martha's Vineyard when his father worked for the phone company. He knew the island mentality well. All my relatives over there hated the Kennedys. It was the old prejudice against Irish Catholics. Smith feared the consequences of a Kennedy accident occurring in enemy territory. Smith called Kenneth O'Donnell. O'Donnell knew only what Smith had told him about the incident. He said, "I haven't been called." The first thing anybody advising Ted Kennedy should find out was who the registry inspector handling the case was. Smith said, "It's a fatal.
So you've got to have a registry guy there making out a report in addition to the Edgartown police. That's the key guy right there on any reckless driving charge.
Smith didn't know any registry people on Martha's Vineyard, but he did know Joe Grealish, who ran the Hyannis office. It was no